You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. It's been 40 years since Martin Luther King Jr. stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. and delivered the now famous I Have a Dream speech. A year before he was assassinated, Dr. King spoke out against the war in Vietnam. The reasons for engaging in that war were later found to be without merit, just as there are questions now as to whether Iraq really posed an imminent threat to the U.S. Yesterday was the kickoff date for the commemoration of the 1963 March on Washington. Martin Luther King III joined Peace Watch yesterday, and we asked him to explain why it is important at this time to have a march commemorating the 40th anniversary of the March on Washington.
40 is certainly a very spiritual number. But when we look at the conditions in our country, in terms of how far we really have come in 40 years, and Victor Hugo used to say, the time is always right to do that which is right. When we look at our conditions, the conditions are not right in our nation. They should be in 2003 and 2004 and beyond, but quite frankly, because the agenda has been driven by those who are very, very conservative, those who are very, very right-wing. The progressive agenda has been hampered. It has not, we never are going to be defeated, but certainly hampered and hindered to some degree. And so when we look at the issues of poverty, racism and militarism and violence, issues that Martin Luther King Jr. addressed 40 years ago, we realize that today there are nearly 14 million people who are living in poverty and 3 or 4 million of those who are homeless. We realize that this is just an aside to that. In 30 months, almost 3 million people have lost jobs in this country with all of this wealth that exists. We realize that while racism is not like it was in 1963, it still is very real when we have an administration that is trying to dismantle affirmative action. We realize that militarism seems to be the order of the day. We've already spent, or nearly spent, $100 billion to go in and destroy Iraq, and we're going to spend $100 to $200 billion to rebuild it. And yet, Medicaid, Medicare, aid to families with dependent children or Head Start, college grants, all of that is being cut. So all the programs of social uplift are being cut, and the only thing we're doing is spending money on death and destruction. It seems to me that American people must say, if we're going to spend $300+ billion on death and destruction, we ought to, at a minimum, spend at least the same amount for life and the preservation of life. And so we are encouraging women and men and families to come to Washington on August 23rd to demonstrate, to protest. This is not just to acknowledge our past, but to build on to our future. We are returning to Washington. We want to repair the damage that has been done, and then we have renewed spirits. So we're returning, repairing, and we are renewed.
Mr. King, on April 4th, 1967, a year to the day before he was assassinated, your father delivered his famous speech at the Riverside Church in New York on the reasons for his opposition to the Vietnam War. Of course, that speech was about that particular war and the circumstances surrounding U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia at the time. But when you listen back to it, do you see a connection, a relevancy to the U.S.-led war in Iraq today?
Well, absolutely, there are parallels. There are tremendous parallels because in 1967, there was a poverty program that had been initiated by President Kennedy and then President Johnson. And the poverty program almost could have abolished, almost, not totally, but it certainly could have put a dent in poverty. But unfortunately, the funds for the poverty program were shifted to militarism. And that war, first of all, we are morally against war. We at SCLC always have been, certainly my father was. So that's the first point. But even intellectually, how the monies were spent was wrong back then. If we had taken the billions of dollars that we spent on Vietnam and spent them to build roads and hospitals and schools, because that's what was needed at the time, then we probably would not have been engaged in a war. As it relates to Iraq today, in a real sense, the similar thing is happening. We did, in this context, however, we decided to go in and just arbitrarily say, we don't like the way you're governing, we're going to wipe you out, we're going to blow you up, and then we're going to come back and rebuild and give contracts to our boys, like Hillenburg and Oil, the subsidiary Brown and Root, that got, I think, $1 to $7 billion contract to put out fires that were started by bombs dropped on the oil wells. And yet that company was headed up by Dick Cheney 3 years ago, and not enough questions are being raised about that. And then the fact that the president is going on a campaign to raise $200 million, $20 million from five or six cities, and yet the money he's raising is being raised by all those folks who are getting those billion-dollar contracts. Nobody's saying enough about this, and it's very sad. The parallels, though, are very, very clear, because the same thing we went through in 1967, we are going through in 2003, and it is said that a people that do not remember their history are, in fact, doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. History does repeat itself, but if women and men of goodwill don't continue to stand up, as many who have stood up, we will never get what we need to have. And the way we do that is we got to participate in the political process. We've got to go out and register people like we've never registered before. We still have enough time to do that for the 2004 election. And really, that's where we need to be focused. And then we got to identify candidates who represent the people, not who represent corporations, but who represent the people. Mm-hmm. And that's who we have to get elected.
Why do you think it is that your father, Dr. Martin Luther King, is primarily remembered for his civil rights work, while the media and history books overlook his work with the Poor People's Campaign and his opposition to the Vietnam War?
Well, I think that it's easier to talk about a civil rights. It's like nice. It's a nicety. Well, the civil rights agenda was a wonderful agenda, and it was. I mean, we did need civil and human rights. I mean, but if you think about it, a Voting Rights Act didn't cost a dime. Civil Rights Act, which actually was initiated first, didn't cost anyone a dime. A Public Accommodations Act, in fact, it made money for people. But when he started talking about redistributing wealth and resources, which was revolutionary, and economic rights, that's what caused him to be killed, and people really don't want to talk about it. They want to make him just, oh, he was such a nice man, which all of that is true. He certainly was, and I don't say that just because he was my dad, but he was a wonderful and incredible, brilliant human being. But he also had tremendous vision, and they do not want that total vision to be seen and embraced, because it can be used as a galvanizing force for women and men and families that are oppressed all over the world. And when the people get on the right side, then issues are going to be addressed.
You've already pointed out some of the glaring similarities between the Vietnam War and the current war that we're in Iraq. But I'd like to ask you to articulate for us, Martin King, what you think your father would want us to focus on most about the war that we're engaged in now if he were still around today.
You know, that's a very difficult question for any of us to answer, including me, who is his son. First of all, I guess the aftermath of what has happened. For example, today we know that every day a troop or two is being killed, and the administration is saying, well, we don't have enough troops. Well, it doesn't matter how many troops you have over there. They're going to continue to be killings because there are people, many people in Iraq who don't want Americans there. How can you maintain order when you come in a people's country and destroyed their land, destroyed their way of life? I mean, you just come in and destroyed things. They want to tell them, okay, I've come and tried to make you do something. Now you need to act civil. When they acted uncivil in the first place, it was America's policies that were uncivil, and the women and men who happened to be in the military who were doing their jobs, but it was in an uncivil way. It was not an appropriate way to create change within in a country. War and violence is the language of the unheard. And when everything breaks down, we don't know how to do anything but to go in and blow something up. That's the only way Americans think. If we don't like what you're doing, we're going to come and blow you up and scare you, and we'll make you do something. So I guess what I'm saying is that when you look at where we are today in 2003 and where maybe we need to go, at some point, number one, we've got to leave Iraq. We've got to allow the Iraqi people to develop the kind of government that they want to have so that they can lead their people. And I guess my father would want to see us do things in a civil and humane way. and not a military way. A military solutions just don't resolve all the issues. And again, there's a moral position there. It's very difficult to totally answer that question because, for example, had he lived,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that we would even have gone through what we've gone through for the last 25 years. Hopefully, we would have been much further advanced in terms of our entire thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we would have embraced nonviolence, which teaches us how to live together without destroying either person or property.
And well, it is certainly a difficult question, Martin Luther King III, and I do thank you for indulging my asking of that question, and I think that your response was quite eloquent. Final question, what are some of the activities scheduled for the 40th anniversary of the march?
Well, we will assemble on the 23rd of August at the Washington Monument, and then between 9 and 12, and about 12 o'clock we will march toward the Lincoln Memorial. Around 1:30 or 1 o'clock, the program will begin, where we will have a variety of speakers from every community, the Native American community, obviously the African American community and the mainline civil and human rights organizations, but also we will have representation from not just every ethnic group, because we certainly will have Islamic women and men, we will have Jewish women and men, we will have some from the entertainment community. We'll have some from the Arab American community. So we're going to have a huge variety of people who will be participating in, again, a coalition conscience. There is a social agenda as well as a legislative agenda. So we will be talking about how we follow up to actually have this legislative agenda enacted and how we plan to inundate our Congress women and men and United States senators to get the legislation passed. We also will be asking everyone to go back to their communities. Every year in January, we observe the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. Well, what a great birthday present would be for us to register 75% of the people of our nation and progressive-minded people, so that by the time the election comes around, and at the latest November, then we're able to elect candidates who are going to be responsive to the issues that we are all concerned about around the environment, around the creation of jobs, around preserving Medicaid and Medicare, just to name a few. We know that this can happen, and it only takes a few good women and men to begin that process.
Okay. Martin Luther King III, we thank you so very much for your time and your very unique perspective.
Thank you so very much.
Any final thoughts on your part?
Well, I know I've said a lot, and what I want to do is to encourage everyone to join us on August 23rd. The actual date is August 28th, which is a Thursday, but we thought it was appropriate to mobilize so that all people who want to would be able to come on the weekend, which is Saturday, the 23rd. And so we want everyone to join us for this this agenda that is an agenda that includes, that leaves no one. You're talking about leaving no one behind, which is something that the Bush administration says, when in fact they're leaving everybody behind except for the elite few. So we're not going to leave anybody behind. We are creating a true agenda that includes everyone in our nation.
Is there a website that people can click
on?
There
is a website. It's marchonwashington.org.
Martin Luther King III, president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, commemorating the 40th anniversary of the March on Washington. Yesterday's press conference at the MLK Library in Washington was interrupted by a bomb threat. Many students graduating from high school find themselves faced with the dilemma of how to pay for a college education or gain hands-on training to build a career. Some choose the military, feeling they have no other options or that joining the services will be their best ticket to travel, adventure, and future career success. As part of Peace Watch's continuing series on military recruitment, our correspondent Ingrid Drake spoke recently with a high school graduate here in the nation's capital who joined the junior ROTC later to drop out. She doesn't want her real name used, so we'll call her Nina.
I was in JROTC my ninth grade year. I was in JROTC till my 11th grade year. Then I dropped out. So I was in there for 3 years. We did drills, basic drills. We went to competitions, trips, fun trips. We just had fun. We did a lot of stuff in JROTC. It was a good experience.
How did they talk about the military?
That if I stay in JROTC for my whole 4 years in high school, then I could get a scholarship, a full scholarship to go to college. They'll pay for my college tuition. They'll pay for my schooling.
So why did you stop?
Because, I'm going to be honest, it was a new major that came, and I just didn't like her. I couldn't get along with her, so I had to leave, get out.
What were the problems you all had?
She used to just, I don't know, nitpick. Like, we just didn't get along. She used to call my parents over dumpster. Like, if she seen me walking in the halls, she'd call my parents for that. If she seen me hanging with a certain type of crowd, she'd call my parents on that. And she wasn't better than my sergeant major, and she got my sergeant major fired. So that's why I had to get out. And my father said it was best for me to get out anyway because we wasn't getting along.
And can you talk a little bit about your sergeant major?
My sergeant major, he was real fun. It wasn't just because of fun. He drilled us so much when we went to competitions. We knew what to do, and we were ready, and we won every competition. But when Major came along, we didn't win anything. I still miss him. He was fun.
What is the drilling? What do you do?
Basic drills, we do stuff like forward march, parade rest, attention, column right, column left. Just drills, we just march, learn how to march.
Did you all ever work with any weaponry?
Oh, no. We had a rifle team, but I never participated in it, so I didn't really know what to do with a gun.
And how many people who started with JROTC in the freshman year do you think finished up and are going to go into the military now?
None. I have a friend named Brian. He didn't even finish school. But I know for a fact that when he finished, he said he was going to be in the military. But I don't know anybody else that wants to be in the military other than me.
And why do you want to be in the military?
Because I think it's a great opportunity. Teach me discipline and train me how to be a young lady or whatever.
And what kind of discipline do you think you'll get? And how do you want to use that discipline?
I don't know. To be a young lady and to know how to act in the real world. They'll teach me all that about how to act when I'm in the real world or something like that.
And what are some of the things that you think they'll teach you, or how do you think they'll teach you those things?
Basically by saying yes ma'am, yes sir, no ma'am, no sir, because I feel that teenagers my age don't know how to respect their elders enough to suit me. I don't know.
And what are the things that they tell you that they would help you learn or develop?
They really didn't tell me anything about that. This is just from my point of view. It's what I think.
And you told me before that you've decided not to choose the military. You're still thinking about it. What are some of your concerns?
The war. I'm scared of heights. I'm scared of planes. I'm basically scared of travel, and I'm going to be homesick. So I feel as though as long as Bush is in office, I'm not going to survive in the military. And I want to survive as long as I can, because he wants a war, and we're going to have another war eventually.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in your mind right now about how you're going to pay for college?
I have a lot of issues about how I'm going to pay for college, because my parents does not have enough money to pay for my tuition, and I'm trying to look for financial aid and grants and scholarships and stuff, and I don't know how I'm going to go about in doing that.
And what are some of the options that you see?
Options about going to school? There are no other options unless I find scholarships, grants, loans, student loans, or just pay out of my pocket, which I know I can't do.
But even though you're worried about college right now, you're still deciding not to go into the military?
Because the military is a hassle. It's too much on me. I don't want to go through that right now. I'm too young for that. I mean, I might later on in the future, later on, when I might, I'm not saying I am, but I might decide to go into the military if it's not too late.
And what do you think Bush is fighting the wars? What do you think he's fighting these wars about?
I don't know.
What do you think about war in general?
I don't see a purpose of a war. Why would you want a war? Bush just wants a war. And it was the same way when his father was in office. So, I guess he's trying to be like his father.
What do you think is the purpose of a military?
I don't know that either. I don't know.
Did they talk about that in JROTC?
They told me for discipline, but I don't see no discipline going on in the military. I don't see it.
What have you heard young people saying to military recruiters about why they don't want to go into the military?
The same reason why I don't want to go in, why I'm scared to go in, because of the war. They said if it wasn't no war, then they would have no problem into going. But it's best to wait.
And what about your friend, the guy who wants to go in? Why does he want to go in?
I don't know why he wants to go in, but he likes JROTC, and he feels that it's going to be the same way in the military.
If it could be a perfect world and you could do anything after high school to, you know, make money for college, what would you be doing?
Military.
Military?
If it was a perfect world, yeah. I wish it was a perfect world, but it's not a perfect world. So if it was a perfect world, I'd go into the military. And that'd be a way for me to pay for college.
And why would you choose that thing?
Because the military, I don't know.
What do you want to do when you grow up?
I want to be a nurse.
Nina is a Washington, D.C. high school graduate who joined the junior ROTC later to drop out. She spoke with Peace Watch correspondent Ingrid Drake of Pacifica Station WPFW. And finally, a political commentary by Barry Crimmins of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
Well, we all saw the footage of George W. Bush landing in a jet on the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln. Leave it to Bush to go to the Abraham Lincoln to lie. The court-appointed president seemed so happy, all dressed up like a pilot and acting as if he were a war hero, that most Americans forgot that when W. had a chance to see some real action in Nam, he joined the National Guard and deserted. But there he was, the returning hero who never went anywhere, standing on the ship. Lashed above the deck was a giant banner that declared the biggest lie of all. Mission accomplished. The sign was meant to put an exclamation point on America's great victory in Iraq. It was also meant to divert our attention from that tattered nation where Bush proved he knew how to start a war but had no idea how to end one. Bush started the war by lying. Only those who believe Alan Combs is a capable representative of the liberal cause still believe that Saddam's Iraq wasn't in compliance with the UN Resolution 1441. Weeks after the U.S. assault that was based on the preemptive assumption that 1441 had been defied, Iraqi weapons of mass destruction are scarcer than ethics at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Anything that is henceforth found over there will be even more suspect than Colin Powell's last testimony before the U.N. Security Council. Not since the original Ghostbusters have so many spooks surfaced from sewers. These noble spies are tired of taking the blame for all the false information Bush used to trump up his war. When the CIA distances itself from the White House to protect its reputation, it's time to fumigate the Oval Office. If this military adventure was intended to put terrorists on the run, it succeeded. Lately, they're sprinting from bombing to bombing. And in Iraq, guerrillas are still killing American soldiers almost every day. Just hours after Bush went to Arlington National Cemetery on Memorial Day to make political hay from Flanders Field, there were fresh corpses heading home. The only undeniably efficient element of Junior's war was to take over the Iraqi oil fields. Too bad the same sort of planning didn't go into the post-war governance of the nation. Where's the quick transfer of power and transition to democracy the Iraqi people were promised? What's Bush figuring? If the United States can't run Iraq, how can the Iraqis ever be expected to do it? 10,000 years of history are missing because W's war provided the distraction that was needed to rob the cradle of civilization. The Iraqi people wallow in post-war squalor. Food, water, and electricity are scarce. Thousands are dead, many more sick or maimed, many heartbroken. It would have been much more humane for Americans to have simply driven their SUVs over there and run the people over themselves. The fake war started with a fake bombing, so-called decapitation attack on a bunker that began. But Saddam wasn't in the bunker because there was no bunker there. But that didn't matter. The decapitation bombing was meant to tell us that Americans know how to bombard an entire giant city and just kill very specific people. It was like saying, well, we're going to cut off food and power and water to Houston for a few weeks, and then we're going to bombard them constantly. But don't worry, we're only going to be killing the Enron executives. The next big lie was the phony story about Private Jessica Lynch, who got injured, treated, and released, and was turned into a giant war hero. And when she came home, she was silenced. What, can you imagine Sergeant York or Audie Murphy being ordered to forego their First Amendment rights upon returning home? Well, they didn't fight for George W. Bush's America, which is a mess. The economy's shot, millions are out of work, the environment's on the brink of irreversible damage, and our civil liberties are disappearing faster than Dick Cheney when he sees a process server. All the court-appointed clown has to offer is some cheesy photo ops meant to stir our souls with visions of martial glory. White House puppeteer-in-chief Karl Rove was so happy with Bush's Lincoln performance that he rewarded him by taking him for a horsey ride afterwards. The footage from the Lincoln will be shown at the 2004 Republican convention in New York at a special Ground Zero debut of the official film of the Elect Bush, Just This Once campaign. W will arrive via hook and ladder, dressed as a fireman, and greet the adoring throng until the evening sky grows dark enough to show Rove's propaganda masterpiece, The Triumph of the Willing.
Barry Crimmins of the political satire group, the Christmas Coup Comedy Players of Pacifica Stations, WBAI in New York, and KPFT in Houston. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Keith Shaljian and Kata Mester. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at Pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening. We'll